This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 105, brought to you in association with Blue Motor Finance, Capital.com and Smart Pension. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Adam Dodds, CEO and founder of freetrade.io, to discuss trading and investing in the digital age. Freetrade.io is a new fintech whose clear and easy to digest strapline is simple zero fee investing. We've dived into digital investment management in prior shows, notably with a super fast growing scalable capital. My ongoing concern over fintech investment management as a whole is that it's not very digital. Sure, there's a nice digital journey, footprint, etc., but it tends to be simply the appization of the standard investment management business model at not very digital fees. It hasn't changed investment management from its core, being what I was doing 30 years ago, and the fees are frankly not a lot different. One key word in FS disruption is disintermediation. I've heard it a lot. The Eurobond markets, for example, which started in the 1960s, were said to disintermediate banks. More precisely, and how often do we get clarity if we step round a word we're trying to understand? What the Eurobond markets meant was that borrower-investor could connect without a bank in the middle. Sounds familiar, eh? So, disintermediating is this. The problem is that, of course, banks are very much in the middle, just another department of the same bank, albeit perhaps the spread between, as it were, interest rates, but its fees, but never mind, between borrower and lender is narrowed due to a cheaper process. And of course, we saw the same claim about P2P as we saw about the Eurobond markets. That is, by, quotes, taking out less in the middle, unquotes, FS as a new, cheaper, superior mechanism. This mechanism, of course, requires a new intermediator, so disintermediation is more like a change of intermediator. And of course, as we covered a couple of episodes back with Christian Faes of LendInvest, P2P has not lived up to the wildly stellar hopes of the true believers. Banks, as always, continue to get bigger. How does this relate to trading and investing? Well, there never is any real disintermediation. There would only be if you, for example, could walk into a BP garage and buy newly issued equity from the bloke behind the cash till. Rather, the important phenomena are whether the new process is cheaper, whether the new process is profitable and scales well for the business, and only then if the new company with that process outcompetes the old. So with this model, and using the disintermediation word here, having established a more sophisticated grounding in it, the disintermediation with digital trading would be to cut out the investment manager altogether, for you just to be able to buy shares yourself. Of course, people have been doing this for a long time, back to the start of shares with the East India Company in 1600. So what can fintech bring to this party? Can fees be low or even zero, as with freetrade.io? Can it outcompete existing players? Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi Adam, thanks for joining me today.
Hi Mike, thanks for coming by Free Trade HQ.
Ah, so you're Free Trade, are you? Not freetrade.io?
Well, yeah, that's our name. .io is our domain name, so if you checked out freetrade.io on the internet, you'd find us.
Ah, yes, actually I should have read your t-shirt. No, because I keep calling you freetrade.io for some reason, and I did actually have some sarcastic remark, which I removed, about the recent trend that I've seen to name your company exactly the same as the domain name. One of my sponsors has been capital.com, for example. So I thought, oh, this is obviously the new trend of 2018 to actually call your company the domain name the same. But actually, yeah, it's my error.
I think that was more like a trend in the year 2000, the .coms, pets.com, diapers.com.
I'm very slow. I'm very behind on my newsletter, so it's probably the case that I'm reading the newsletters in the year 2000, but it would explain it. So we were just talking about the fact that some time ago you left university in Canada.
That's right, yeah.
And rather than heading east, you headed west, which, if you're in Canada, tends to take you towards Japan.
Yeah, I guess you go far enough west and then you're in the far east again, aren't you?
Yes.
But yeah, no, I did some traveling after uni, ended up in Japan for a year teaching English, managed to find myself a lovely wife, and ended up coming back to Canada after that to train as an accountant. That was back in the days of the financial crisis.
So when were you in Japan then?
That was 2007 I graduated.
And you were in Tokyo?
Tokyo, yeah, right in the mix of it.
Teaching English foreign language, TEFLing? Or...
Yeah, generally to business people that were getting sent overseas. Our largest clients were Sony, Computer Entertainment, Honda. Train up the guys before they have to go overseas.
And how much Japanese did you manage to learn?
I could order beer in an izakaya.
Another one, please. The Japanese have this strange and interesting way of numbering things by their shape. So, as I recall, ippon is the number for one for something that's kind of tall and cylindrical, like a bottle of beer. But ichiban is number one for other things. And I think there's another numbering system for people, actually. It's rather fascinating aspect of the language. I mean, I was there quite a bit in the late 80s when it was still sort of big boom time, but of course by 2007 it had been sort of flatlining for some time. So what was the zeitgeist there? Is there still sort of fun going on despite all these economic stats?
Well, I guess it was 10 years ago for me now. My wife tells me that it's changed quite a bit though in the last decade or so, and she's noticed that it's a much more open society or country now, where there's a lot more immigrants and a lot more tourists in Tokyo now. So I'll find out though. I'm going back to Tokyo this summer for the first time in 5 years since my daughter was born, actually.
Yes, the first time I went was 1984. That was actually on holiday, and we were traveling down Tohoku, the northern part of it. And in those days, I had long sort of fair hair down to my shoulders and I was the only guy, you know, in some of these, every town we went to, basically. And, you know, I do remember a whole coachload of Japanese schoolgirls walking up and down through the corridor looking at me and giggling because they hadn't seen a gaijin up there. But of course, that changed quite a lot, actually, even by the 90s. Tokyo was full of foreigners.
Yeah, I think your celebrity status would be a bit eroded now.
Yes, now I'm just nobody special. So as you were then saying, so you went west to end up in the Far East, but then you went east to end up in the Far West and settle down and did something sensible like working for KPMG.
Yeah, I trained as an accountant, chartered accountant, did my 3 years in Vancouver actually before testing out the KPMG network, going to Cayman Islands for a bit and landing in London just, I guess, 3 years ago, almost 4 years ago now. Always as an accountant, and then the final year I spent with KPMG was in M&A covering fintech. So that's kind of how I got into the space.
I see. And so presumably in the middle of one night or one morning, you woke up and you thought, enough of sensible jobs, I'm going to do something crazy and I want my own fintech.
Well, you know what it was? I came over here, you know, new country, and I needed to open up a new investment account. And I couldn't find anything like what I was really looking for, which was kind of a Robinhood equivalent. And I was just gobsmacked at how expensive it was to do the self-directed investment thing over here. And it was really clear to me that this was going to happen in the UK and someone needed to do it. And I felt like I had the right kind of background and understood the business to make it happen.
And so you formed the company when then?
That was 2015. Really, though, it was about 2 years ago that I ended up leaving my job at KPMG and going full-time with Free Trade, raising the first little bit of pre-seed money to build a prototype, get some guys together to build a team as well.
And how many are you now then?
We're growing every couple of weeks. We're adding new bodies, but I think we're about 12 right now. Our plans are to kind of double that in the next couple of months because we just closed a recent round of funding. Actually, the share certificates are going to be issued on Friday, and that was $3 million that we raised on Crowdcube. And that brings our total to about $4.5 million that we've crowdfunded in the last 2 years with about 3,000 investors or so. And our last round we did in 1 day.
Wow.
So $3 million 1 day. I think it was the most overfunded equity crowdfunding campaign ever.
Oh, excellent, excellent. Well, you've obviously got a good marketing team. So we'll come back to Free Trade a little bit later. But diving into the main course in terms of this trading in the digital age, I haven't covered this one directly before, so maybe we can start off with sort of the super big picture thing. We've got all these species of fintechs. We've got the P2Ps, we've got app-only banks, we've got crown funders, blah, 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 blah. And there are starting to be straws in the wind of more trading-orientated firms such as yourself, Capital.com, as well as the old existing incumbents having apps to let you interface with them to a greater or lesser extent. So how do you see this subsector of fintech in the UK at the moment?
Well, I think the reason why you haven't maybe covered this on your show before is because no one else is doing it yet. And coming over here, I think when I look at the investment landscape in the UK, I find it quite antiquated and a bit obsolete, to be honest, where most people and most assets are stuck into these mutual funds. So I think the FCA is pegged the amount of retail assets in investments, something like 1.8 trillion pounds. And a really, really small percentage of that are actually sitting in, you know, ETFs and in direct holding of shares. So the investment industry for decades now, they've been pushing people into these mutual funds that are generally actively managed and frankly ripping off their customers with these embedded fees that are not visible. People don't understand what they're actually paying for. And what we're doing is we're giving people access to what I would say is the new paradigm or the new type of funds, which are low-fee passive ETFs, exchange-traded funds, that they're paying basis points in fees rather than percentage points in fees.
Yes, and we'll come back to the FS bit, but I like the introductory thing about you came over here and found it old and antiquated. I mean, many North Americans come to Europe and find it as a whole old and antiquated.
Well, that's a super big appeal, picture, right? Yeah. lovely old buildings and everything, but
so yes, it's all antiquated. In terms of this regulatory landscape, how do you see that shifting?
Well, I think we've seen the regulators come out with reports recently. The gold standard in the CFD industry are the likes of the listed companies like IG and Plus 500 that actually do a pretty good job of educating their users about their products or the risks surrounding that. But there's a long tail of less savory firms that conflate investing in shares and in ETFs with CFDs and spread betting and blurring the line between those two types of products.
Yes, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because it's a cultural phenomenon. I mean, at one perspective, I remember the editor of the Evening Standard, whatever his name is totally gone for me, who was a very grey hair. He was the editor of Accountancy Age in the 1970s, and I don't pick up the Evening Standard, but occasionally I do. Anthony Hilton, and he always writes brilliantly. And one of the points he's been making for some time is that you can walk into a betting shop, put £1,000 on the horse, not have to prove you know anything about horses or betting or whatever, but you can try and stick 100 quid in investment or in a crowdfunding site, I think he was talking about, and you have to fill in a whole bunch of forms and all that kind of stuff. So quite who controls what and how it's controlled and all that kind of thing is very much an open debate. And as you say, it's always going to be changing. I mean, from my perspective, in terms of, let's call it semi-professional, personal investors, folks I've known in the city, spread betting's been around for donkey's years. That's what traders do. And you know, from my perspective, if we're talking about people who know what they're doing, I'm not talking about my mother, who should not touch that kind of stuff. But if we're talking about financially sophisticated people, just forgetting regulation and all these things, to me, it doesn't really matter where I have to go out there and buy, I don't know, a mutual fund, which is invested in the sort of, you know, is a passive fund to invest in the FTSE, or I buy a FTSE future, or I buy an ETF, or I do a spread bet. You know, if you know what you're doing, it amounts to taking the same risk.
Yeah, I don't disagree with really anything you said there, where these products are appropriate for a small subset of the population that do know what they're doing. Our community, however, we have about 40,000 people in our community. The average age is 29. Most of our community members have not invested before in directly into stocks. And part of the reason for that is that there's a lot of confusion out there. You know, am I going to lose money? I see a story about how the average CFD customer loses £2,000 a year, and they don't understand the difference between that kind of a product, which, as I said, I don't have any problem with it being out there and an offer, and a buy and hold strategy for building a portfolio over the long term, over decades. Because if you're 29 years old, you have decades left, and this is the time to invest and enjoy those compound returns, right?
Absolutely, I entirely agree. So what we're focusing on there is that there is a spectrum from, should we say, gambling through trading to long-term investment. And if you're putting money aside in some ISA or something for your kids' school fees and you're not even married yet and all that kind of stuff, then that's definitely investment. And I suspect the principal parameters, as you refer to, is a question of time scale. You know, if you're putting money aside for 10 years, you don't want to be messing around with futures or options or CFDs or anything like that. You just want to bung in something that you know is going to be around in 10 years' time. Equally, going back to the demographics, I mean, Ruz Bebatcha a few years ago was on the show talking about information for trading, and, you know, there are a hell of a lot of 20-somethings that do a ton of trading. I mean, I was a professional fund manager myself for many, many years, and I never did anywhere near like the trading, even in my day job, that some sort of folks do, you know, trading Apple shares and all that kind of stuff. There's a bit of a fad for it. But the thing that you're touching on there is the question of financial education and whether it's gambling, trading, investing, or anything like that, basically putting your money into stuff. The principal concern that I would have, and I don't know what the FCA's position on this is the very simple one of diversification. So let's say one of my daughters downloads your app in a bit and she buys one share in something, in BP. You know, that's obviously much higher risk than buying 100 shares in a bunch of stuff or buying a sort of FTSE EFT or something like that. So how are you guys approaching the topic? Are you just literally a vehicle for people actually managing to buy and sell shares? And as it were, it's up to them to educate themselves? Or?
Yeah, that's exactly what we are. We're an execution-only stockbroker. We do not provide advice. We're not regulated to provide advice. Over time, though, we would like to add features that add value for our users to help discover new investment opportunities, to help understand how diversified their portfolios are, both geographically through different asset classes and whatnot. And where we see our average user is someone that's investing the majority of their portfolio in a handful of passive low-fee ETFs, gaining exposure to the broader market, and then maybe buying some Amazon or some Tesla to top up their portfolio, overweighted into a few names that maybe they feel like are going to outperform the market over the medium or long term.
Yes, I see. Well, I think that's the right answer. If you're trying to be efficient execution, then you know, zero fees. We'll come back to your business model a little bit later. Then, apart from the regulatory thing, you can't have whole teams of people trying to educate people. And I like the phrase execution-only stockbroker, because I haven't heard the phrase stockbroker for many, many times, and everything goes round and round. And sort of saying earlier, we bought a stockbroker in 1985, which was about the last time I remember hearing the word stockbroker. And that's a very interesting way of looking at it. So there is a question then. I mean, I mentioned BP as an example. Everyone's heard of BP. On the ETFs, and we did a podcast about ETFs in the past, there's a question that there's loads of ETFs out there, and it's quite hard to know which ones are good and bad and ugly. So just taking that as an example, I've been in FS for over 30 years. And so I've left a bunch of money in LNG UK Tracker Fund for ages, which has outperformed everybody else, who's at the minute in active funds, lower fees in its index, et cetera, et cetera. And I've known for some time that actually I shouldn't do that because they're charging me too large fees for what I'm getting and I should get an ETF and yada, yada, yada. At which point I write it down on my to-do list and never quite get round to it. Because if you don't know anything about ETFs, maybe there's a book out there or a website which says choose your ETF or something. Because there are millions of them, aren't there?
There are. What we've done, our approach is to simplify the universe available. So we don't offer every single ETF out there. I think that's very confusing, especially to a novice user. We're going with the biggest ones. So we've got Coke and Pepsi, so to speak, iShares, BlackRock iShares, Vanguard. That's the starting point. We're going to expand off of that, but you might have, we'll have some maybe Spider or Gold Shares, the largest, most liquid securities in the world that also have the lowest embedded fees. So
right. And so what are the fees in these kind of ETFs then?
Single digit basis points. At least in the States, the ETFs are. I think Vanguard just dropped their UK version, the fees embedded in those as well. That's where I'm putting my money. That doesn't mean I'm advising anybody.
Of course, you're not giving advice. Yes, and so going back to my complaint at the beginning, which is that a lot of the nutmegs, scalables, etc., at the investment management end are doing a very good service for people, but they're not really very digital yet in terms of their fees are still, for the sake of argument, 0.75%. For all I know, Legal & General is probably doing me 0.75% or 0.5% on the index fund or something like that. When you're talking about single-figure basis points, you're really talking about a much more digital approach, which is an order of magnitude cheaper. And that really starts to compound. It sounds like not a lot, but it compounds over the years.
It does, right? So what's the average expected return, if you're just passively investing in the stock market over whatever, with 100 years or 50 years, you're looking at somewhere between 5 and 10%, right? A 1% fee drag is huge. That's a massive amount that's going to impact your, whether that's your pot at the end when you're going to retire, and that compounds over many decades, right? So we do look at the fees as, 1% is a massive amount. So to justify 1%, Nutmeg's got to be doing a significant outperformance of a passive fund. And as you know, a very small percentage of active fund managers or fund managers full stop do outperform the market overall.
Absolutely. And I've seen that for 30 years, and I'm amazed that salaries are still high in investment management. But that's one of the things I just shake my head at. As you mentioned, the different expectations of the younger consumers these days, 20-somethings, whatever. How do you think they see these kind of things about gambling, trading, investing? What's the perception amongst your community of these things?
Well, I think I touched on that briefly earlier, where there's a bit of a confusion out there in the market about what is investing and what is trading, what is stock trading. Is spread betting stock trading? I would say no. That's betting on the movement of a stock. But perhaps the larger kind of issue is crypto. So crypto's part of the, you know, the zeitgeist right now. And I think if you asked a random 25-year-old, do you have any coins? They're more likely to have some coins than they are to have some stocks. And in a way, crypto is a bit of a gateway drug into getting into investments. And that's the way we look at it, where a lot of the younger generation is getting their kind of dipping their toe into crypto and then realizing, hey, this is
crazy.
Yeah, well, you know, super volatile. And what they need to understand is that there's probably a place in your portfolio for that, but it's a small percentage of your portfolio and you need to be diversified, right?
It is gambling.
Well, it's speculation, yeah. It is speculation for sure.
So I see. I hadn't come across that one before about crypto being sort of the gateway drug for getting into sort of more sensible investments. Back in the day, going back to being a stockbroker, with the whole privatisation thing starting in the 80s with BT, there was a huge push from the then Conservative government under Margaret Thatcher to widen share ownership, to give people a direct stake in capitalism by holding capital themselves. And there was a very wide holding, a large number of people increased enormously who actually held shares. And then it contracted quite a lot as well. People took their profits and just sold them, and then they ended up in mutual funds and all that kind of stuff. So do you have any knowledge around whether investing over time is coming back into fashion or stock holding, individual stock holdings, or as a cultural phenomenon? Because it seems to be, it was pushed as a big thing in the 80s. It really increased, but then it's kind of waned. Is it coming back to this crypto thing and that?
I think it absolutely is. And I think that the mindset of the millennial consumer is quite different than maybe previous generations, where, especially in other European countries as well, where I think maybe the boomers just assume that the government's going to take care of them, that they can count on their pensions. I don't think that there's the same trust in government and that we're going to all be all right financially. So people realize that they need to take care of themselves and start investing for their future. And I think millennials are a lot more thoughtful about that than the media gives them credit for. We've experienced that certainly in our community.
I mean, slightly off topic, but how have you managed to acquire so many people in your community?
I think there's just this incredible latent demand for what we're doing. And our initial crowdfunding campaign was like 2 years ago.
Right.
And we didn't have a community before that. We had 170 investors participate in that, and that was the seed that has grown now into 40,000. And people are telling other people about free trade, and they're referring their friends to sign up to our wait list to get first access to this product that they've been wanting for a long time. Because if you're someone like myself, where, you know, I used to work at KPMG, a relatively well-paid job, professional job in the city, I still only had a few hundred pounds at the end of the month that I could potentially put into my investment account. When you're faced with a 12-pound commission from Hargreaves Lansdown or from Barclays or wherever, that is a huge percentage of what you want to invest. And if you want to diversify those few hundred pounds into multiple holdings, you're stuck. You really need to go and save multiple months just to invest in three ETFs, which is insane.
Absolutely. You remind me of the Woody Allen joke about a stockbroker is a man who invests your money until it's gone. But you're the new generation of free execution-only stockbrokers, which should avoid that problem. Okay, so that's the kind of background to it all. And I can see how all these things come to a confluence. And one of the reasons that I was very interested to speak to you guys, even though you're not exactly up and running at the moment, is that I think it's absolutely something that the market's been crying out for some time. If it's made simple and easy in a digital fashion and it does spread, then one day everyone should do this. There is no need to go to a legal and general and pay for me to pay a bunch of fees when all I want is some passive investments that sort of sit around for half of forever. So getting into actually this whole thing about execution only stockbroking, I think it's probably the better phrase, because the trading and investing, I mean, you know, once you've got an ETF and you buy one thing, well, actually, that's quite like an investment if you've sit on it for ages. If you buy and sell it 15 times a day, that's like trading. So you're actually just a conduit for people to buy and sell shares. So you'll tell us about when you're getting live. I saw something the other day saying that you'd actually done an end-to-end trade yourself. So it didn't disappear down a hole in the middle, which is good. So it's working again to be released. So let's say your app is out, now, though, and I click on it and I put £10 into BP. What actually happens behind the scenes? I mean, going back to it's taking you guys 2 years here, there must be a lot of stuff to connect together. What actually happens to the money and the shares and all that kind of stuff? How does it actually work?
Yeah, sure, I can walk you through it. And just to be clear, our app is working. We are a functional stockbroker right now, and we have started out the rollout. It's just we're going to do it slow and steady.
Very
and
wise.
We are a new stockbroker. We need to make sure that all of our processes are functioning properly before we expand to a large number of clients. But yeah, we are a functional stockbroker.
I just thought it wasn't public, so I didn't realize it was kind of this sort of private rollout. And that's very wise, because going back to privatization, there was a privatization of British Gas. And some lunatic at Kleinwort's or Grievesons or what it was, decided we'd do sort of, it wasn't free share trading, but like £5 a share or something.
Yeah.
And this was back in the late 80s. And of course, that's immensely successful. It was so successful, the back office just got deluged in a ton of paper because it was paper that says, and it was an utter nightmare. It was the biggest cock-up that I've ever seen in equities ever. So the last thing you want is suddenly going out there and having a billion people trading on your app and your computer overheating and all that kind of thing. So absolutely incremental approach. Anyway, so schematically, then behind the scenes, so let's say I'm one of your early users and I press a button and somehow transfer £10 to you and I want a BP share.
Yeah, so well, the first step is to onboard as a client. We have various regulatory requirements there, you know, AML procedures, anti-money laundering for those that don't know the jargon. But let's assume that we've onboarded you and you have an account with Free Trade. First thing, you need to fund it. Pretty simple procedure. You go into your banking app and send a faster payments to our bank account, and that's a segregated client money account held with Lloyds, and that's ring-fenced.
So if Free Trade blew up tomorrow, my money was with Lloyds, and I can ask Lloyds for my money back.
Exactly. And there's very strict regulations surrounding that from the FCA that we have to adhere to. We get audited by PwC to make sure that we are doing it properly, etc. So now you've made your transfer of funds. You've got £1,000 in your Free Trade account. You want to make that first transaction. You press buy. What happens? That's kind of your question. And we are a London Stock Exchange member firm. What we do is we go out to the market makers, also called retail service providers, and they are the ones that are always ready to buy and sell.
And this is presumably done by API these days.
Yes, it is. It's all electronic, right? And it's not like we are innovating there where we're the first person to do electronic communications. This is standard stuff, right? So we go out, we find the best price for you in the market at that time when you press buy, assuming that you're paying the £1 for an instant trade.
We haven't mentioned that, but let's look at the side bit. So it's a freemium model that you've got, which is that, as I understand, I can do my £1 or £1,000 trade. I can put it in and I pay no commission at all, and you execute that at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm.
Or I can pay £1 a trade and you execute it straight away.
That's it. So you have two choices of type of trades. In the future, we'll be probably adding other kinds, so limit orders and the like. But for now, free, basic account, basic trade, executed at the end of the day in bulk. You're not price sensitive for intraday. Or you can get an instant trade for £1.
Right. So I've got my app and it's on my phone. Type in BP or something. Yep. And I press buy. And so going back to how these computer things work, so the phone then contacts what, your server or something? Or?
Yeah, exactly. It plugs into our proprietary platform and we plug into the plumbing of the London Stock Exchange. And we go and find you the best price. There's 35 market makers that we can connect to. And we agree a deal with them, and that's called execution.
And it's best execution, presumably, because the computer's
absolutely
checking the price.
We have regulatory requirements surrounding best execution. We don't make any money off of this. We're not selling deal flow. We're not doing any of that kind of stuff. We're just going out there as an agent for a client to get the best price available at the time for their size of order.
Okay, so you're connected into the stock exchange because you remember my phone's contacted your computer, your platform, and then your platform plumbs into that, and platform has a chat, and then it buys me BP shares at £3.47 or whatever. Okay, so that's the orders executed. Then what happens about settlement then?
Yeah, so this is the one part that most people don't understand about kind of the trade life cycle. And when you execute something, that doesn't mean all of a sudden everything's done. There's T+2 system here in the UK, it used to be T+3. And T+2, what that really means is trade plus 2 days. So 2 days later, we exchange cash for securities or vice versa. And we do that through the UK and Ireland single settlement engine called CREST. It's owned by Euroclear. It's the central depository where all securities and bonds, not all bonds, but basically all securities and bonds or equities and bonds are held in digital form. And it's just a matter of a book entry in this master database to say that it moves from wherever, Peel Hunt to Free Trade Limited. And that's really all there is to it.
And so you hold my share as Free Trade then?
We do. We hold it in a nominee, Free Trade Nominees Limited. That's the standard way that stockbrokers hold the securities for their clients. And we do that again, it's to make sure that it's ring-fenced and it's clear that these are client securities and not property of Free Trade Limited.
Yes, I'm old enough to remember when your share would turn up in the post in an envelope.
It's funny because I'm a Hargreaves Lansdown customer and I still get every quarter, I get something in the mail asking if I want to place orders through the mail.
Yeah. Well, the share certificate came in, and also transferring shares, you know, there's a bit of a tear off at the bottom. So you write it in, you send that off in the post.
And
everything would move around. Okay, so that's nice and clear. And you explained it very simply and schematically. But presumably, in terms of actually executing that and building all that technology, it takes a little bit of a while, which is why it's taken you a year or two to get here. That's not the work of an afternoon to make all that happen.
It's not. It is a bit of a difficult path. And I think we were talking about intermediation, or you were talking about disintermediation. I think the easier path is to plug into someone that's already built all the infrastructure and you just layer on top of that. But you're not going to get the cost savings that we're experiencing as a full stack stockbroker, where we are connecting to the exact same infrastructure that AJ Bell is, or Hargreaves Lansdown, or Barclays. So we have the same kind of overheads or direct costs as any other stockbroker. Where we differ, though, is in the back office and on the kind of IT systems that we've built in the last
now,
2 years.
Now, not 20 years ago.
Exactly, or 30 years ago, or even longer than that, some of these guys, where they're stuck on these legacy infrastructure that can't do some of the cool stuff that we can do.
No, absolutely. And if you had done the easy thing, which is to have some nice shiny app, but just sit on top of the sake of argument, Hargreaves Lansdown, you do a deal with them and you give them all your stuff, That would be sort of adding extra intermediaries to it. Yet somebody else could have taken out some money from the whole trade. So I think it's the right thing to do, even if it's the hard thing to do. And just finishing off on this sort of trade flow thing then. So in this sort of digital age, what is my proof of ownership, as it were? So PensionBee, you were on the show a little while ago, and they were saying that one of the things that they solve is that, I've forgotten, but the average person joining the workforce now will have 12 jobs over their life, will end up with 12 pension pots. And I certainly know this myself, is that when you're young, you don't think of these things. In old money, you just got a piece of paper, and you stuck it in some folder somewhere. And then, like, actually, I suddenly realised that I haven't heard from my pension, Climate's pension for over 10 years. I thought, shit, where's that? So I'll try and find a piece of paper, find it, and da-di-da-di-da-di. So I've got that piece of paper. But one of the things that PensionBee does in the modern age is keep track of all that kind of stuff. So how do I, in this modern world, keep track of all my shares?
Well, through the app. And we try and do it in a way that's very easy to understand and is intuitive and that is just as user-friendly as the best apps you have on your phone. But ultimately, it's just presenting the same data in a different way. We do still have, you know, regulatory requirements to present data in a certain way. So while we may present it in the first instance in an abbreviated format, you can always drill down and get your contract note and get every single detail that you would ever want. You're still going to get your quarterly statement with every detail that you could ever want.
So you get a quarterly statement on the app or through the post, or you print it off? Or
digital only. We don't have any printers or anything like that.
Yes, no, it's just the from a longer timescale perspective. You know, if we're in 20 years' time, I hope Free Trade has taken over the whole UK and you're massively successful as you deserve to. But maybe it doesn't exist in 20 years' time. Maybe Monzo doesn't exist. Maybe PensionBee doesn't exist in 20 years' time. And as I say, having had this thing recently where I'm still on an old paper system with this, at least I've got a piece of paper in a file. And I move house several times and all these life events happen. And I've got some piece of string. Whereas in the pension world, we're not talking about pension, but in the pension world, you do come across pensions where people have just lost track of it and can't find a way of accessing it. It's really a question of that, even in this digital world, an individual is wise to have some, I personally think, wise to have some kind of, as it were, a backup system that doesn't rely on the Monzo app or something like that.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can have your own digital backup of this stuff, and if you really are, if you really want to, you can print it off.
Yeah.
But the technical term is called a durable medium, and that's the requirement from the FCA. And that doesn't mean it has to be paper, but if you have a PDF, personally, you know, I have all my bank statements in PDF format, and that's in the cloud, and I feel like that's actually a better way of storing.
Because your house can burn
things
down, my folder of pensions can burn down, I've got nothing then.
Exactly.
Okay, well, that's such an interesting topic, but time is going on. I'll have to find an expert in that sometime to talk about, which is that in a purely digital world, over the longer time scale, technologies change and all that kind of stuff. I mean, I've got some cassette tapes at home. They're unplayable now. I've got some VHS, so yada, yada, yada. And words like cloud seems sort of still relatively sexy in the modern world. But, you know, by the time you're a great-grandfather, your great-grandchildren are going, oh, great-granddad, you're still talking about the cloud.
Okay, cool. Because yeah, when we look ahead at what do we see as impacting technology in the sector going forward, there's a huge buzzword right now, blockchain, blockchain, blockchain. But in our vertical in fintech, it's actually very applicable. And there are a lot of banks out there. You know, there's the R3 project, there's the digital settlement coin. And the application of blockchain in our space, I think we will see in the next 5 years, because we touched on that antiquated settlement cycle, the T+2. There's no reason why in today's digital age that we couldn't have instantaneous settlement. And I think blockchain will enable that, and we will see that in the coming years. I think in Australia, they've already started that project because they're fully integrated, vertically integrated, the exchange and the central securities depository, everything's kind of owned by the ASX. So it's kind of like the easiest test case.
It's an interesting question. We don't have time to go into it now. And I would like to go into it sometime when I find people whose sort of day job that is. I mean, what particularly annoys me, and the listeners will know, is that there's so much focus on blockchain, which is a type of computer technology, but actually does, as you referred to with Australians, what matters far more to me is the institutional infrastructure. So, for example, let's say my house burns down. I have no record that I own my car. However, the DVLA, the government body for that, will have a record. So in principle, I can go knock on their front door, or I can call them up, and there will be a record which persists that I own the car. The same way with my house. If my house burns down, I mean, I don't actually know how I prove I own the house, actually, off the top of my head, but let's hope it's at the land registry, and not all property is in this country. There's a huge amount of property isn't covered land registry, but it is. And in the same way, going back to the institutional framework, forgetting the sort of computery stuff, it would be perfectly conceivable and might even be a good idea if, for the sake of argument, the London Stock Exchange kept a record in whatever computery way it wants. So then whatever happened to the outside world, if DVDs went out of fashion, if clouds blew up, if people's houses burned down, there'd be some persistent record assigned somewhere. And I think that's still a question that we're in this period of transition, and we're just each time updating the technology, but we're still embodying prior concepts. So the prior concept that's still embodied in terms of the model that you're talking about is that, as it were, there's a notionally physical piece of paper that shows Mike Ballyman owns these shares in BP. It's no longer a physical piece of paper, but actually it is something, you know, in a nominee company, but that's basically the same idea. And there are lots of those nominee companies spread around. But again, there's no reason that one can't then move on from that, because now the stock exchange can. In principle, every stock exchange can, in principle, have a computer big enough to remember who owns everything.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
You've got to what the land registry developed as, and the DVLA with cars and all this kind of stuff. But anyway, we're not there yet. So before we talk a little bit more about free trade and your rollout and what you're after and which listeners should check you out, I'd like to thank all the listeners out there. And I'd like to thank my brand partners of the podcast, Blue Motor Finance, who are, according to the 2018 FT1000, the fastest growing FS business in Europe. Blue's award-winning technology has supported over $1 billion of lending, working with over 3,700 UK motor retailers. Capital.com, making CFD trading more accessible and engaging in 23 languages. 500,000 downloads in 51 countries. Check out Capital.com or download the app. Trading is risky. Smart Pension, who are fast, secure and free. Check out their UK workplace pensions at autoenrollment.co.uk. So, Adam, we've mentioned free trade once or twice, in large part, as you say, because there's no deep market here. It's not like P2P, where at one point there were 125 P2Ps. There are not many folks doing what you're doing. And you've touched on your rollout. So how is the rollout going? How will it continue? And when can an enthusiastic listener start getting access?
Well, right now is a super exciting time for us, because we dropped in the App Store a few weeks ago.
Android?
iOS App Store, Apple App Store.
There's all this sort of racism and sexism thing these days. I want an Androidism. The whole word.
Android is coming. We've got engineers in the next room. They're working night and day for it. I think we'll be in the Play Store within a couple months. About 40% of our community
I feel I'm part of a second-class society. I'm the oppressed minority.
It's a bit easier to do iOS, so that's, I think, part of the reason why a lot of fintechs go iOS first. But yeah, Android's coming pretty soon after. We have almost 40,000 people on the wait list in our community right now. We're rolling out to them first, and our first priority is actually our crowdfunding investors. That's happening now. and will continue to happen over the coming months. So if you want free trade, get your email on there, freetrade.io, and you can move up the list by sharing with your friends.
So it sounds exactly like the Monzo one, where it was a restricted thing. You can share with your friends, you're on the list, as I was, and you get golden tickets and all that kind of stuff. That worked extremely well for them.
Yeah, and some exciting news to share with you too is this week we just got our regulatory passport. So what that means is we're not going to be just a UK financial institution. We will be open to the 500 million market as long as we're still in it.
Well, at this rate, we're going to be in the EU forever, but let's not get onto that one. So that would mean that you can trade in any European country.
Well, we're going to give access to European markets as well, but the critical piece is that we can onboard European citizens, not just UK residents as well.
And I should have asked, what is the domain of investments? Are they just things traded on the London Stock Exchange at the moment? I can't buy, for example, Japanese shares.
Yeah, that's right. So right now it's just LSE traded stuff. We're going to be adding US securities within the next couple months. And from there, we're going to roll out pan-European and look at, we're looking at Hong Kong as the next market that we might add.
So no wonder you need all these millions and these ever-growing staff, because there's quite a lot of work to be done in all that.
There certainly is, and there's a whole load of features that we want to be building that we're prioritizing with our community's feedback, and that's what we're going to spend the $3 million on, building out our engineering team, and also a world-class customer service team as well. So you'll be able to access our guys and ladies through the app, in-app chat, and you're not going to be there alone if you don't know how to use it.
It's a funny thing, because you mentioned guys and then corrected yourself. I remember in the 70s, there was this big deal that guys refers to men and women, because that's not sexist. It's calling them guys. Anyway, so it took me a long time to reprogram myself, because guys and girls were stuck in my mind. Anyway, so I started saying guys, and I said it to my daughter and that kind of stuff. And of course, the whole wheel goes full circle. So it's now sexist to say guys and not guys and girls. You know, it's very hard to keep up with the fashion about what one's supposed to say.
I've heard a lot of usage of the word folks.
I use folks now, because it's like a neutral thing, but that can get a bit folksy. Excellent. Well, thank you for that, Adam. It's very interesting. It's a rare day that I come across a new subsector of fintech, and one that is truly digital. And I think you are truly digital. Anything that is virtually free or minimal costs is a bona fide digital thing. And in terms of execution, that is far better than what you can do by going to any old school bricks and mortar stockbroker. So I think you really are in a great territory to be, and it could be a really exciting journey in the next 5 or 10 years. It remains to be seen how all these millennials or these sort of older folks get their heads around the technology and what investment means and all that kind of stuff. But then going back to layers and excess intermediation or new intermediation, you know, there's no reason that once the likes of you guys and others start building what you're building, that somebody can't actually sit on top of that and do an education piece for like 10 basis points per annum. We educate you about all these stocks and shares and all that kind of stuff, and go through our partners like Free Trade, which actually probably I should ask you about Free Trade, that at the moment you're focusing on being your own brand. Do you have any ideas or plans to sort of white label yourself or stick yourself in Monzo or Revolut as sort of, you know, a button that they can press there and invest some money via you guys?
Yeah, we're definitely looking at potential integrations. It's not our priority right now. But yeah, we'd love to be able to, I don't know, let's say you're using Monzo and you can put some money in your Free Trade account through the app very painlessly through API integrations. We're also considering opening up our API to other fintech firms to build on top of. Probably not till 2019 though, so watch this space.
Good. Well, as I say, I've lived through a situation where the back office was an utter crisis. This is when there was pieces of paper for a long time, and it was a nightmare. And there's nothing you can possibly do worse than to have something which is really appealing to people and opening it to everybody in one go. You know, so it really makes sense to do that. But I wish you every success in the future, because as I can say, you know, next year, the year after, I can see that with building blocks like the business that you're building now, that can be a really useful component of something which takes you and something else and, you know, builds some interesting things around it. So thank you for that, Adam, and I wish you every success in the future.
Thanks, Mike. It's been great talking to you.
Thanks for listening. If you have consulting, advisory/non-exec, or media needs in the FS or fintech space, get in touch with me at mike@londonfintechpodcast.com.
Could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. Come away from the city, with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, with the faces so gray, with the pain of the the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me, 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 watch the firelight dance.